discussion here is among various points that of discharging and not discharging semen, which we may think is an unusual subject to be discussed in a spiritual assembly. However, this was discussed in the spiritual assembly on the bank of the Ganga, where Parikshit Maharaj was sitting, Shukadev Goswami was speaking, and later at Naimisharanya, the same subject was discussed. Now, especially in recent times in India, this kind of discussion has been considered, at least not with women present, it's considered something not proper. Of course, modern India has changed, and it seems to be the main topic of discussion in modern India. Just as an aside, I was doing a Google search yesterday for juhi, the flower, but the flower came much later. There was one film actress. So many websites donated to this. A prostitute, actually, if we were to speak frankly. She's just a prostitute. And film actress means just prostitution, showing off their bodies. So it seems that there's so many websites dedicated to this unchaste woman. An Indian film actress. So it seems that modern Indians are very serious about discharging semen. And it's quite open to talk about all these things among certain modern Indians. They're promoting this. But it appears in this ancient Indian culture, it was also discussed from a different perspective among the spiritually minded people. It was discussed, as Prabhupada has written here, semen is meant to be discharged when one has a home, a wife, and the intention to beget children. Otherwise, there is no injunction for discharging semen. So Srila Prabhupada, following in the footsteps of great sages of the past, he would openly and publicly discuss these subjects. In India or not in India, Srila Prabhupada was presenting the truth of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is Vedyam Vastavam Atra Vastu, the highest truth. Srila Prabhupada translates this as Srimad Bhagavatam propounds the highest truth, distinguished from illusion, for the welfare of all. So you may think, well, this is not the highest truth to discuss about discharging or non-discharging of semen, but it's all related, because one who is dedicated to discharging semen, like Daksha, he doesn't achieve the perfection of life. Daksha, of course, is a great personality. Anyone who is featured in the Srimad Bhagavatam is a great personality, including Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. You may say, well, they're demons. It's true, they're demons, but they're great demons. It's, you know, all the little demons of Kali Yuga, they don't make it to the Srimad Bhagavatam. Big demons, they're mentioned. So Daksha is a great personality, no doubt, and he was very pious to have the position of the Prajapati, one of the Prajapatis, one who gives or is entrusted with populating the universe, practically Daksha Prajapati. In the generations just following Lord Brahma, he's the principal in many ways. He gave, well, Kashyap, of course, gave so many, also, so many species of life. But Daksha was a very great personality, and this chapter, which we're just beginning, is about Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj leaves home. How Dhruva Maharaj left home, and eventually he performed tapasya, and eventually had the darshan of Lord Vishnu. Well, Daksha did also. Daksha also performed austerity, and he also had the darshan of Lord Vishnu. But there's a great difference between Dhruva Maharaj and Daksha Maharaj. When Lord Vishnu appeared before Daksha, he blessed him. Yes, you have many children and fill up the universe. He wanted him to do that. There was a need within the universe for populating it. So he was blessed by Lord Vishnu to do that. So there's nothing wrong with having children. It's not talking about this verse and purport is discussing discharging semen. It's not in and of itself intrinsically wrong to do so. But Daksha, he considered that was the be-all and end-all of his life. He didn't, unlike Dhruva Maharaj, who also, when he grew up, married and had children. But Dhruva Maharaj is not remembered for his having children, but for his bhakti to Lord Vishnu. Whereas Daksha is remembered for the Daksha Yajna. That's how he's mostly remembered. Not even for having many children. He's mostly remembered for the big fight he generated. And that word, or that phrase, Daksha Yajna, is up until recently has been a term which means a big quarrel. Of course, in modern India they don't use all these terms, but in traditional India all these kinds of phrases would be used because the culture was based on Puranic knowledge. So Daksha Yajna, that means a big quarrel. All these terms, just like you'll say, there's Agni Pariksha or Lakshman Rekha, all these terms are there. They'll be used in day-to-day contexts. And people understand what they mean. Even, I think only about 10 years ago, I saw in the Deccan Herald, a newspaper from Hyderabad, and in the editorial, it was referring to Singhava Lokanyai. And it was they presumed their readers understood what it meant. How many sitting here know what Singhava Lokanyai means? Anyone? Singha means the lion, and Avalokan means glancing. So it said that the lion, when he walks through the jungle, he looks back like this. So this is used in various ways, but the example means that when you're going forward, have a look back also. Keep aware of what's going on around you. So that's one way that's used. So that was the culture. Modern India is the discharging semen culture only. Daksha was more cultured than just discharging semen, because he was a deva, he wasn't a demon. Vishnu Bhakta Smito Daiva. He also was considered a devotee of Lord Vishnu. But he didn't have the bhakti that Dhruva Maharaj had. He didn't have the here in this verse Srila Prabhupada uses the word unadulterated. Unadulterated brahmachari. So, Daksha, he didn't have the unadulterated bhakti that Dhruva Maharaj had. Here is described the unadulterated brahmachari. And the names of some of them are given. Sanakadayaha, Narada, these are famous. The Chatusa and Narada Less famous are this Ribhu, Hamsa, Aruni, and one more, the name is given Yati. Actually, they're all Yatis in the sense that they're all sannyasis, they're renunciates. So these persons are famous, but there are others who are equally or more famous who are not brahmacharis in the history of the universe. Srimad Bhagavatam gives the religious history of the universe. So there are many grihasthas also, as Srila Prabhupada pointed out, in regard to the Dwadash Mahajana, famous 12 Mahajans. What was it? There's 7 grihasthas. Swayambhu. Let's count them. Swayambhu is grihastha. Narada is brahmachari. Shambhu. Pralada. Who comes next? Kapila. Kapila. Manu. Hey, I'm going to... Pralada. Pralada Jaina, but I said Pralada already. Swayambhu, Narada, Shambhu. Kumara. Okay, so it's one on that side. Anyway, 7 and 5, it splits. Pralada Janaka, Bhishma, Valiya, Vyasaki, Vayam. And in mentioning them, Yamaraj, he didn't group them into these are the brahmacharis and these are the grihasthas, because in pure devotional service, it doesn't matter. It's narrated about Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was, of course, famous as a Naishtiki Brahmachari, that one professor or some prominent gentleman, he came one time to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur and offered obeisances to him. And he said that, well, if this Siddhanta Saraswati, he's offering obeisances to you, then I should too. You must be a very great person if he's offering obeisances to you. Siddhanta Saraswati, even from the worldly point of view, he was a great personality. I mean, at the age of 15, he smashed all the astronomical misunderstandings of the age, and he was writing books and teaching people old enough to be his grandfather. He was a highly gifted personality. He was very intelligent. He was recognized as being extraordinarily intelligent in an age, at a time when people in general were much more intelligent at the present time. People at the present, they're not very intelligent. If we see the level of discourse in the age of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, it was just normal that the people they moved among were highly learned in Shastra. So many people knew so many philosophical theories, and no one nowadays. It's what goes on in the name of philosophy is mostly just pathetic. Most people have no idea. People are so far away from any philosophy that you can expound any rubbish, completely bogus idea, and people will accept it. Otherwise, how could it be that in modern India, there are so many completely, totally bogus people who are posing as spiritual leaders, and they have many, many followers. You'll find there's some fisherwoman from Kerala who goes around hugging people. This is her main qualification. And people think, this is wonderful. It's spiritual. It's love. And they may quote some, I don't think her herself, but they'll quote some Upanishad. Someone somewhere will throw in something from the Upanishads, and that's supposed to be the justification. And that's just one example. There are so many. This can only happen because, for want of a better term, Hindus are, apart from being anurdvareta saha, apart from discharging their semen all over the place all the time, they have absolutely no touch with their pure philosophical culture. And therefore, they at the lowest level of degradation of Mayavad, they can just accept anyone who claims to be so as God or spiritual, because the term spiritual has lost any quantifiable meaning. It's just if you feel spiritual, then it's spiritual. But Srila Prabhupada, following the tradition, he presented Krishna consciousness as a science. He would always use this term, it's a science. So we might think that, well, science, that's just a term Prabhupada used because people are interested in science. But actually, that's partially the reason, but actually Srila Prabhupada presented Krishna consciousness scientifically. That means that it is a subject matter that is meant to be accepted with the intelligence. Jnanam teham savijnanam idam vakshami asheshata yajgyatva neha bhuyo nyaj gyatavyam avashishyate. Krishna didn't tell Arjuna, now I'm going to tell you I'm God, and you accept it or I'll throw you in hell forever. As that was the religion I was brought up with. You should just believe it, otherwise you go to hell forever. But Krishna doesn't say that. He does say that people can go to hell, but he explains to Arjuna that I am now presenting to you jnana, vijnana, knowledge, practical application of that knowledge, by knowing which there will remain nothing else to be known. And Krishna presents it very systematically, that there is Ishvara and Jiva, Maya and Karma and Kala, and the interactions of these constitute reality. Proper understanding of these subjects, that is self-realization. And not understanding of these subjects means degradation, contamination, binding in this material world. So it's presented very systematically, but it can be understood only by persons of purified intelligence. Srila Prabhupada used that term, purified man. He translated the term sadhu. Of course, he translated it in various ways, but in this Shrinanti Gayanti Grinanti Sadhava, those who are sadhus, he translated this as purified men who are thoroughly honest. So those who are purified, they can understand this. Now the emphasis is here given on brahmacharya in this verse. And there's no doubt that it's important. One can do good brain, one can have a good brain if one is a brahmacharya. But that in and of itself is not the criterion for understanding God. This principle of brahmacharya is central to Vedic culture. Vedic culture got hijacked. The Buddhists, they did the first hijack. Not the first. The Jains, Buddhists, but anyway, Shankaracharya, he restored the Vedic culture without the essence. He brought back all the formalities, but without the essence. So in Vedic culture, Mayavadis and Vaishnavas, they agree on many points, that we accept Veda, especially Shruti, and then all the various points, cow protection, Brahmacharya is one of the points. We'll find in the Shankara Sampradaya, this is very much emphasized, because Shankaracharya himself, for him, spiritual life begins with accepting sannyas. So it's an important principle in the Shankara Sampradaya. And we'll find among the Mayavadis, I'm talking here not about the Kerala fisherwoman type, but the traditional sampradayas. They're very strict about this point. They're very strict about observing rigid brahmacharya. That's why I heard in the, that Kanchi Kamakoti Peetam in Kanchipuram, the headquarters of the Shankara Sampradaya in Tamil Nadu. They only use tamarind if it's 20 years old, because otherwise it's supposed to be bad for brahmacharya. But if it's 20 years old, it's okay. So such things they follow. So they're very strict about it. More than us, we don't do that. We don't bother about whether it's 20 years old or not. So they're very strict about that, but they don't have access to Krishna consciousness. Rather, they're blocking it by their philosophy. So brahmacharya is important for understanding this philosophy, for brain, this the brain inner, that we know from the Daksha story. Daksha eventually got the head of a goat. So his intelligence remained the same. Actually, we could say that he had somewhat goat-like intelligence anyway, to insult Lord Shiva and to be more interested in the activities of the genitals than in spiritual realization. He hadn't come to the point of athato brahma jignasa. He was more on the karma mimamsa platform, that athato dharma jignasa. They're in karma mimamsa, they're interested in dharma, but their dharma is Even Chai Dharma Anuprapana. They're interested in the dharma of the Vedas, which is concerned with enjoying this material world. So the brain in and of itself is not the intelligence, but it's a medium through which, in the conditioned state, the intelligence functions. So just like if one has to serve Krishna, if one has to bring water from the river for the deity, nowadays we just turn on the tap and have all this contaminated water. But traditionally the system is that the water is collected from a river or from a well, which is only used for the deity, or from a pond, which is only used, or a tank, which is only used for the deity. So just like one's body has to be healthy to serve the Lord, so the brain should be also. If one is to understand this philosophy, then it's not possible for people who watch TV. For various, not only the subject matter that is shown on TV, but also the kind of the radiation, all these kind of things that negatively influences the brain. It has one devotee who is an astrologer. He was telling me that he'd met some big astrologer in Jaipur who said that TV is under the classification of the astrological classification. TV comes under Ketu. So that's not very auspicious. So people who are watching all these titillating things on TV, the intelligence is always, every second, the screen, it's changing, quick, 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 quick. So the the ability to think deeply is spoiled because the intelligence is kept at a very shallow level. And we see that In the modern age, people are very shallow. They're not capable of thinking very deeply. They have no practice. What to speak of practice, they have no introduction to it whatsoever. It's just like an animal. You can't teach philosophy to an animal. He has no thinking process. Thinking process may be there. You can give a monkey, you can set some kind of test for a monkey that if he does this, 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 and this, he gets a banana. So the monkey has some intelligence. But the monkey cannot think deeply about philosophy because he's a monkey. Yet his intelligence is jumping around. And here's a picture of Hanuman. He wasn't an ordinary monkey. He was a philosopher. He's a brahmachari. There's not many monkeys. That just shows that Hanuman is not a monkey as we know. Because monkeys, they're never brahmacharis. So he's not a monkey as we know. So, if one's intelligence is always jumping here and there, then one cannot go very deeply into any subject matter, which means he can be very easily misled. And even basic points of logic, people, they don't follow or they don't even think about it. I was just seeing this. There's one magazine called Back to Prabhupada, which is a takeoff of Back to Godhead. So it's a magazine which is glossy, looks good, looks... So anyway, the point of the magazine is to show everything that's wrong in ISKCON, especially everything that's wrong with ISKCON gurus, real and imagined. And this is supposed to show that the vada, or the what they say, sometimes translated as philosophy, but it actually means just what someone says. Their idea of Ritvikism, this shows that it's correct. Because you see, everything's wrong in ISKCON, and therefore our theory, we've shown everything, we know what we can see, what's wrong clearly, so our idea must be right. But it's a non sequitur, which means that the conclusion doesn't follow from the premise. That's the supposed solution to all the problems, but it doesn't necessarily follow. So it's like that. If something is if something is presented in a glossy package, people tend to think it must be correct. Especially if there's some apparent reasoning or presentation of evidence or logic, apparent logic. There was another book one book called The Authorized Sarasvara Parampara, something like this, in which there was a very nicely printed book, and it's supposed to show how the arguments to show why the parampara of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is correct. But a lot of although it may seem like very good arguments, but actually I happen to know, because I'm in this line, that One of the main arguments they gave was that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was against Bipin Bihari Goswami, who was the official Diksha Guru of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But there is no actual evidence that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur ever was disrespectful to Bipin Bihari Goswami. So, but because it's presented in a book which looks very authorized and says it's authorized, and people tend to accept that it's true. If something comes on TV, on the news, people think, well, it must be true. I saw it on TV. on the news, must be true. Prabhupada watched the moon landing in 1969 on TV. It was live on TV. Prabhupada was looking at it and laughing and saying, this is just a hoax. No one at that time except Prabhupada said it was a hoax. Prabhupada said it was a hoax. And practically the whole world accepted it must be true because we saw it on TV. No one thought that, well, there are movies where they show this kind of thing also. So it could be a setup, but they didn't believe that. No one could imagine that it could be a hoax because we saw it on TV and they reported it to us. So Srila Prabhupada, he always presented Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. When one of his disciples rejected Srila Prabhupada because he could not accept that our great America, you're belittling America who sent, we did the greatest act in the history of mankind. We went to the moon. And Prabhupada saying didn't, it's a hoax. So he left, Purushottam, he left Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, I can understand why he might not believe me, but how could he doubt Shastra? That's a very significant statement, isn't it? That Prabhupada, he didn't claim himself to be the arbitrator of knowledge. But as a genuine guru, he presented himself as a transmitter of the truth received through Shastra, through Parampara. He didn't say, I said, therefore you should follow. But rather, he accepted this. He showed this is the standard. And that's the standard for a guru. That's the standard for all gurus. They should present what is in Shastra as understood through Parampara. Not just Shastra. That's also because Shastra and it's Shabda Jala Maharanyam. It's a big forest. How are you going to find your way through it? Then you need a guide. And the guide is the guide who's been guided himself. So this is Amnaya, the Shastra received through Parampara. In this way we can understand. Not that Srila Prabhupada says something or he will purport to say something and that breaks. Or there's no Shastric evidence for that. So on this, in this way we have to understand the Shastra, Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada set up this system of discussing Srimad Bhagavatam each morning. Because there are many points to be understood. If one has the brain power to enter into this, if one is not watching TV, if one is not going to the sexy websites, then the brain may be steady enough to enter into these subjects. It's a subtle subject matter. That here it's stated, urdhvareta saha, brahmachari. So it may be considered that they are in some way better than the grihastha devotees. Well, in some ways, you could say, at least a superficial manner, or from our level, yes, maybe it's better, because the brahmachari life means the opportunity to absorb oneself fully in spiritual activities. That's the meaning of brahmachari, who is absorbed in spiritual activities. Whereas grihastha life means there are so many distractions, apart from the point of urdhvareta saha, of not discharging semen, there are many distractions. On the other hand, one who is on the highest level, for them it doesn't matter. If one is on the highest level, then it doesn't matter whether you're having children or not having children. It's not that one is, he doesn't have to practice anything. Nitya Siddha doesn't have to practice bhakti to become self-realized. That's why Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who had 13 children, his position is far more advanced than many, many sannyasis, even Vaishnava sannyasis, what to speak of Mayavadi sannyasis. Because he's a great pure devotee of Krishna. Not only pure devotee of Krishna, but as he has revealed, he's a servant of Radha and Krishna. So all these points have to be understood very finely. Recently I was sent a text that someone had made one brahmachari in our movement had made an essay showing how seeing the devotees in our Gauriya Parampara and matching that with their swarup in Krishna Leela and trying to make a case that the brahmacharis and sannyasis, they're more elevated than the grihastha devotees. It's completely bogus. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that's the example. Bhaktivinoda Thakur was a grihastha most of his life, and he is the root of what we're doing. We're sitting here is all Bhaktivinoda Thakur's contribution, actually. He began the movement for reviving the Gauriya Sampradaya. He gave it, he put it in context in the modern age. He trained Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He had the vision of spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. He wrote books in the modern genre. He gave the songs which form the basis of our liturgy here in ISKCON, and even more so in Gauriyamad. This misuse of the Gauriya Sampradaya by the Sahajiyas, he saved the Gauriya Sampradaya from that. He began the work of saving it without, he didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. He kept the principle of the Gauriya Sampradaya to worship, the worship of Radha and Krishna in the Vipralamba Bhav. He retained that without the contamination, without the misunderstandings that had been brought in. So, such a tremendous figure, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And someone's trying to suggest that I'm a brahmachari, I'm better than Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Such a person, they must be discharging their semen. What can I say? They have no intelligence to understand these points. They're foolishly thinking that I'm in a better position than... That was the implication. I'm in a better position than Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So, it's urdhva retasah. It's important. No doubt. For grihasthas also. No doubt. But seeing everything in context. We should see everything in context. That it's not the essential point in Krishna consciousness. Even Ajamil was a good boy in his youth and he spent all his life discharging his semen and doing all kinds of, in an illicit way. And doing all kinds of sinful activities, but at the end, this story of Ajamil goes to show the power of bhakti. Actually, all these narrations of Srimad Bhagavatam, they go to show that bhakti is not only superior to all other process of elevation, but superlatively so. That even if one has absolutely no fund of pious activities in any way whatsoever, and even if one is completely sinful, if one somehow or other in that situation comes in contact with pure devotional service, then he can attain that perfection of pure devotional service which remains shut to even very pious people or very self-controlled people who have no bhakti. So this is the overwhelming fact which is presented in Srimad Bhagavatam, and that's there in Bhagavatam again and again. That's stated and then systemized in, this is systematically presented in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, in Bhakti Sandharva, how the importance of bhakti overrides, actual bhakti overrides that of all other pious activities. So there's nothing more to be said at this point about the brahmacharis mentioned here. They'll be mentioned more later on, but in the description of the dynasties, there's no dynasty coming from Sanaksananda, Sanat, and Sanaksanandan, Sanat, and Sanatan. There's no dynasty coming from Narad or Ribhu or Aruni, but they'll be featured. Definitely the four Kumaras and Narad. Narad is everywhere featured in Bhagavata because his position is so important as Narada, as the giver of Narayana. He gives Narayana all over the universe to all kinds of, in different species of life, all different persons. So Narad, his glory is not that he's Urdhvaretasa. That is, it's also, that's there, but his real, in the last class I gave, I was saying Lord Shiva's glory is not his tapasya. Narad Muni's glory is not his brahmacharya. The glory is their bhakti. And even if one doesn't have any particular qualification, there's that one verse is given, where does that come? In Rasik Mangal, is it? That's quoted, Chaitanya Mangal. That Ugrasena, he wasn't a powerful king. He was humiliated. He wasn't a great kshatriya. He was overwhelmed by his own son. And Ajamil, he wasn't a pious person. Gajendra was just an animal. So in this Sudama, he wasn't rich. So completely lacking material qualifications. Nevertheless, all these persons were blessed with pure devotion because that's what they aspire for. They're pure devotees. So Bhagavatam establishes the glory of Bhagavan and of Bhagavad Bhakti. This process, this is far superior. It's in a different category, even to that of merging into the impersonal Brahman. Hare Krishna. Is there any question, please? Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, he did severe austerity and even though he did not aspire, as soon as he had darshan of the Lord, he became a pure devotee. But in case of Lakshmi Chaudhary, he had darshan and performance. And later on, he did tapasya and again he had darshan.
He didn't get it. He missed the point. Again and again. Why does it happen like that? Well, there may be various factors. Just like Srila Prabhupada was preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world, and he said basically the same thing wherever he went. He told people, you're not the body. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should surrender to Him. Please give me that book. This is an example of how not to keep Srimad Bhagavata. When we get the new book, we should cover it nicely. So this is not, we're supposed to serve the Shastra, but this is disservice. This shows our disregard for Shastra. Please look after the books nicely. So anyway, there may be various, Prabhupada was preaching all over the world, basically the same thing, but some people took it and others didn't. So there may be various factors. With Dhruv Maharaj, we see that one factor is that he surrendered to Narad and accepted his instruction. So in that way he was blessed by Narada. As Srila Prabhupada writes in one purport, that the blessings of a pure devotee are more important than one's own endeavor for attaining devotional service. But there may be, like I say, there may be various factors. Just like one devotee once asked Srila Prabhupada that it's said that one cannot come to bhakti without having pious activities in previously. But in our lives, we said we were just all sinful. So how could we take to bhakti? And Prabhupada said, he gave different answers at different times. At one time Prabhupada said, well, that was superficial, he said. Because as soon as you came in contact, you took it up. So, like I say, there may be various factors. Daksha, of course, he'd also made some offenses. So, he couldn't. That became blocked to him. Now, Dhruva Maharaj, he was also Bhogaishvarya Prasaktanam. He was also... Well, he wasn't so much attached to Bhoga and Aishvarya in and of itself, but for him it was a prestige matter. He was attached that, you know, I should be respected properly. If we look through the commentaries of the Acharyas, they may give some particular insight, but in general we can say that in all cases there are various factors. There's activities performed in previous lives, both favorable and unfavorable for bhakti. There are the blessings of pure devotees and one's willingness to receive them. These are all various factors.
Sometimes we find some misunderstanding that the brahmacharis can render devotional service better than the grihasthas. Is there any quality of devotional service that one offers by which the spiritual master is satisfied or the Supreme Lord is satisfied?
Well, in one sense it's true that the brahmacharis can render service better because they at least quantitatively, in general, they can do more because the grihasthas are busy with other things. Qualitatively, well, that's up to the individual. Although, especially in the modern age, previously grihastha life didn't mean that you worked 12, 14 hours a day, as in the modern age. Previously, that meant that morning and evening and midday also, in many cases, one would have some spiritual activities, whatever one was doing. If one was a Brahmin grihastha, then he'd have, depending on what he was doing, but it's just, you'll find that many of them, they were all day in the temple. So, but in general, the brahmachari, at least quantitatively, they have more time to serve and therefore they can do more service. And that also means more time for sadhana, which is purifying. Because if you're working 12 to 14 hours a day, then there's not much time for sadhana. It requires time to chant the minimum of 16 rounds a day. It requires time to hear Bhagavatam without having to look at your watch. You have to run off. I'm already over time here in this class. So, of course, grihasthas who are living in the temple, they have a kind of privileged condition compared to most grihasthas. But in general, generally speaking, it's a better position to serve Guru and Krishna. Although it's not necessarily so that we should think that a brahmachari is better than a grihastha, or vice versa. Because it may be that a grihastha is more sincere than a brahmachari. And sometimes grihasthas, even though they have less time, they do a lot of service also. So It's like this question of the brain. The brain isn't all in all, but if one has good intelligence to enter into spiritual philosophy, then that will help one to discriminate between spirit and matter and help one on the path of advancement. It's not the crucial factor, but it is from our platform, from the condition. We're down here trying to get up there. So it's better to have a good brain than cow dung in the brain. So generally speaking, we can say that brahmachari life is a better position than grihastha life for executing spiritual life. The very word brahmachari means that. Although in some cases, or many cases, it may be better for the individual to be married because he's not suitable for brahmachari life. So we can't make any one blanket statement about this. Except that it's time to finish. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Jai Krishna. Hare Krishna. As usual, after class, I'm advertising my books and CDs, but I think almost everyone here is a regular. Not irregular, a regular. If you're irregular, then become regular. Hare Krishna.